occurred. And if you can imagine, I mean, we got off, there was three buses, we pull up, and I'm like, why are we stopping here? And it's like, well, this is 1 Samuel 17, and I'm like, doesn't look like much here, you know, there's not even a Coke stand or anything. But, so we get out of the bus, and we're walking, and well, this is the place, and he says, this is where David and Goliath fought. And on one side of this Valley of Elah, the Philistine army was there, thousands and thousands of men on one side, and the other side, the Israelite army was there, and they're getting ready to do battle. And it's interesting when you go there and you go to these places where all this stuff in the book took place, and it has new meaning for you. But anyways, so you've got this Philistine champion, and his name was Goliath of Gath. Even the name's kind of scary, Goliath of Gath. And a champion sometimes back in those days, if you had two armies that were going to fight, in order to save murder and killing and bloodshed, they would just send one fighter from each army, and they would decide the outcome of the battle. So that was why they called him a champion. Goliath was said to measure 6 cubits in a span, and translating that into our system of measurements, a cubic being 18 inches and a span being a half a cubit, that makes Goliath 9 foot 9 inches tall. So he's a pretty big dude, okay? Now, some people, you read the commentaries, they argue a little bit about how tall he really was, and was he really 9 foot 9? I think he was just big, you know, whether he was 9 foot 9 or 8 foot 8, I don't know, but he was a big guy. And not only that, he wore a bronze helmet, and he had a chain maul, you know, with the to protect you from swords. They said that that coat weighed 5,000 shekels, which is about 126 pounds. So his coat alone was 126 pounds, plus his helmet. And then he had bronze shin guard, and he carried a bronze javelin, and he carried a spear that weighed 600 shekels of iron, about 15 pounds. So I'm adding this up. He's carrying about 160, 170 pounds of stuff on top of himself. And I'm guessing he probably made 350, 400 pounds on his own. That's just a guess. He also had a guy, great job if anybody's interested. You could be the shield carrier and you'd walk in front of him. So you'd carry his 9 foot shield and go up first. And so my guess would be this would be a very, very scary sight if you were there. So in verses 8 through 11, it says that Goliath challenged Israel to battle twice a day for 40 days. This battle didn't just take place. For 40 days, Goliath came out and probably pounded on his chest and you know, challenged him in the morning. Come on, who's going to fight me? Who's going to fight me? The average size of a Hebrew back then, I think, was about 5'5", 5'6". So this guy's like almost twice your size. So kind of scary, but so twice a day, every day, 40 days, he comes out and taunts the Israelites to fight. So I always get a kick out of 40 in the Bible. Does anybody know how many times the number 40 is mentioned? Well, no, it's more than 40, but it's mentioned 80 times in the Old Testament and 66 times in the New Testament, a total of 146 times. They seem to like the number 40, you know? And when you start reading about the number 40, and you can read the commentaries, you can Google it, it doesn't matter. It's a very significant number because Jesus was in the desert for, Moses lived in Egypt in 40 years in the desert. Moses was on Mount Sinai for 40 days and 40 nights before he received the Ten Commandments. The Hebrew people wandered through the desert for 40 years. So you kind of see this is going on. The kings, Saul, David, and Solomon, each ruled for 40 years. And Abraham bargained with God not to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah if 40 righteous people could be found. And then this, I didn't know this. I found out just yesterday. The Bible was written by 40 different people. So that doesn't exactly fit with what I'm going to say, though, how many people wrote the Bible. That's an actual number. But the number 40 should not be taken literally as 40. like 40 days, it means it's a long time. It's a period of testing, of trial, of tribulation, of probation. It might have only been 10 actual days. It might have been 70 days. It might have been 2 years. We don't know. But when they use the number 40, it's meant to be kind of a time of trial. And see, now I'm untethered here, because you can ask my wife, because next month we're married 40 years. So if you think about trial and testing and things, you can talk to her about that. So the other thing, I'm a big Jeopardy fan, and I always try to watch it if I can. I always used to kid when our kids were little and in Sunday school, and they, well, I don't know the answer. I'm like, just say Jesus. Jesus is always good, you know, whatever that's. So now I would say Jesus, and if that doesn't work, say 40, because that's probably the right answer as well. So if you're on Jeopardy, try it. So let's go back to David and Goliath. So twice a day, this giant Goliath came forward to taunt Saul, who was the head of the Israelites. And the verse said, terror seized them, and they were dismayed and greatly afraid. Their fear showed a serious lack of trust in God and in God's covenant promises. Okay? So it's saying it's a lack of trust of God. Jesse, and I remember Jesse is David's father, is mentioned along with, not too many people know this, David had three older brothers that they don't get too much press in the book, but he's got three older brothers. And they were old enough and had been taught to engage in battle, but you know what? They didn't like, hey, Dad, I think I'm going to go out and fight Saul for you. You know, no, they didn't do that. Afterwards, if you read it, God didn't select any of those three to be king, but he does select David. So before David steps up to the challenge, Saul makes offers for someone amongst the Israelites to answer Goliath's challenge. And in exchange, if they were willing to do it, he offered them freedom. And freedom back then meant A, no military service, no conscription. You know, if you're in the military, you'd be done. You'd never have to fight again. And you never have to pay taxes again. Most of you hopefully paid your taxes a couple of weeks ago. So if you were 18, 19 years old, no more taxes. But nobody came forward, even with that promise of reward. Then in verse 26 through 30, David asks, now you got to think, David's this little puny guy. He's maybe, they say he's a teenager, so I'll say he's 13 years old. He's a shepherd, kind of like the lowliest job out there, you know. He's just a little squirt. And he says, who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should taunt the armies of the living God? Now, I would say those were fighting words, you know. It's like, so this little kid, who are you, you know, that you're going to taunt the living God? So here comes the little guy. He's got no military training, no experience. He has the audacity to challenge this giant Goliath. And David's father, Saul, tries to prepare him for battle. And what does he do? Does anybody know? Saul offers David his armor. And David refuses. He defies reasoning. I mean, who would, a teenage boy wouldn't listen to his dad? I mean, that works every time. So now he says, I don't want your armor. You know, it's too heavy, and I've never worn armor, and it's probably not going to help me. So he refuses it. On the contrary, David decides he would trust in God, not human devices, to accomplish what he considered his mission of taking down Goliath. So he picks up 5 smooth stones from a nearby stream, and everybody says, well, why is it 5? He only used 1. I don't know, you know. I'm not sure. It doesn't talk anything what he did with the other 4, if, you know, in case he missed. I don't know. But this stone here, this could have been the one that took him down. And Susan, she picked this up in the Valley of Elah. And we have 3 of them. She couldn't find 5 because probably every tourist has been taking 5 home with them. And they're running short over there in Israel. But this is one of the stones that was laying in the valley. And it's possible it could have taken him down. Not highly likely. But it was a stone just like this. So 9-foot-9-inch giant taken down by this little stone. I could throw it at Russ and I probably wouldn't do much with it. So, but this is one of the stones. And he's got a slingshot. Now remember, Goliath is wearing a bronze helmet, and he's got all these shin guards, and he's got chain mall on, and a javelin, and this big shield in front of him that his lucky shield bearer is carrying for him. And he shows up with five of these and a slingshot, you know, and it's like, well, what's going on here? And some people, like when I think of slingshot, I think of, you know, like, don't poke your eyes out, you know, don't shoot at your brother because, you know, you'll hurt him or something. You know, not as a very deadly weapon. But one thing I found out when we were on mercy ships, we had the security detail for the ship consisted of 8 Gurkhas. And Gurkhas are the nicest, baddest people you'd ever meet. They're these little guys from India. They're Nepalese Special Forces. And they would smile at you, and they just knew everything. And they would be on the gangplank, where you got on and off the ship. And we had a computer scanner, and you have to scan in and scan out. And they made sure everything was cool, you know. And at night, in the evening and through the night, there'd be 2 of them up there, and plus a third one would kind of be patrolling in the port just to make sure everything was okay. And they were all very little. I mean, I was a giant compared to them. And this one guy, Ming was his name, he just used to smile. Oh, and because I used to go on and off the ship like 2 or 3 times a day, so they knew me quite well. And he called me Mr. Mike, and one, Mr. Mike, and he shook my hand. I'm telling you, he just put his thumb in the right place. I was on my knees with tears coming down, you know. It's like, you know, that's just how they were. They were very, very highly trained in what they did. So one day, we were out smoking cigars, actually, on the dock, myself and the head of security, this young fella from upstate New York, and the Gurkhas worked for him. And I'm like, so Reuben, do we have any weapons on the ship? You know, we went through, we sailed from Cape Town to Madagascar. You know, do we have any weapons because of pirates and things? And he was like, I took that to mean yes. You know, I was kind of hoping we did. You know, we had God, but we also had fire extinguishers too. So why not have a few weapons? So it's like, okay, do we have any weapons? Well, he never really said that we did or we didn't. He says, I'll tell you, yeah, there's some weapons. The Gurkhas have slingshots. And I'm like, slingshots? What do you mean slingshots? What good are those? And he says, they're really good because they're up about the equivalent of about 3 stories, because I think it was deck 5, so you're pretty high up. You had to go 2 flights of stairs to get up to the ship. So they were up there, and he says, you know, they have these slingshots, and they can hook them onto their wrist, and I've never seen one, but he says, they could take you out right here on the dock and you wouldn't even know it. He says, they're very lethal, they're very quiet, you never know. And so who am I to laugh at a slingshot? But so anyway, so David had one of these slingshots. I don't think his was the wrist model. I think his was the, if you read in 1 Samuel, it's the twirl around your head model and let it go at exactly the right time. And I would be hard-pressed to hit Russ Munson with a basketball from here, let alone to put a rock between his, you know, his eyes with a slingshot. So here's Goliath. Here's David. Goliath's got all his stuff on. David shows up with 5 of these and a slingshot. This is, like, kind of really irritating Goliath now. It's like, you know, I'm just going to crush you like a little ant. You know, you're nothing. What are you doing here? So he looks at him in complete disgust and disdain. And then they also said something. Some of you know I play racquetball twice a week now, at least. I used to play more often. And now we have some more Christian people, so everybody's kind of cleaned up their language a little bit, mainly me. But years ago, Paul was talking about basketball. It's the same thing, you know. It's like, you're a pastor, hinder. You know, it's like it just gets crazy sometimes. And sometimes the language, you know, we trash talk each other pretty good. You know, it's like, you know, okay, when you miss the wall, it's like, okay, you got to get the ball up a little higher next time. You know, just to kind of get under their skin. So David and Goliath, they're not fighting with, like, high-powered rifles, and they don't have long-range missiles, they don't have drones. They're fighting mano-de-mano, face-to-face. Blood's probably splattering when these guys fight because they're right up against each other. So before the battle begins, they curse and shout expletives at each other, and they're kind of getting everybody going for this. So you got the little kid, you got the big giant. So you know the rest of the story. The rest of the story is David takes Goliath out with one shot, hits him right between the eyes. He's wearing this helmet with the face guards and stuff. He manages to get it right in there, takes him down. The Philistines on one side, they're like, oh boy, we're done. Their champion lost. They turn and they start running. They head for the hills. The Israelites, they're cheering. They won. They're going to head back to Jerusalem. What does David do? Cuts off Goliath's head, takes it back with him to Jerusalem as a souvenir. I'm not quite sure why, but that's what happens. So is this kind of a story just about the underdog that wins? You know, it's a typical story. It's like underdog up against the big thing or the big guy. You have the individual up against the big corporation, things like that. You know, you can't fight City Hall, that type of thing. Sort of like, if you remember, I spoke about Israel before we went. If you think about Israel's really tiny, there's only like, you can fit 7 Israels into the state of Illinois. So it's not much of a, in terms of geographic size, 7 million plus people. There's like 1.5 billion Arabs that live surrounding them. I mean, this has got to be God, because you'd think they could just overrun them. It would be nothing, but it doesn't work that way. So anyways, what's the point of all this? I think, do we have an answer to every one of our questions? I think the title of this is, For Every Goliath, There's a Stone. And I'm not sure if there is a stone for every one of your Goliaths specifically, but I believe there are a few lessons that we can take away from the story that might help in our everyday lives. So I was thinking about the Goliaths, you know, that I've faced, that you might be facing. I know some of your stories a little bit, and pretty impressed by some of them, you know, some of the things that you've been through or are going through, and things like unemployment, financial problems. Maybe you have a mean, uncaring boss. Don't go with this. Health issues. Maybe you have prodigal children, prodigal grandchildren, a cheating spouse, a divorce. We get down to the addictions. Oh my gosh, we got lots of addictions. Drugs, alcohol, pornography, gambling, eating, sex, shopping, on and on and on and on. All kinds of things. Satan has he's thought of everything to kind of get us off track. You know, no matter what our bent is, he's got something that he can kind of whisper in our ear and say, hey, why don't you try this? This might make you feel better. You might like this. It won't hurt you. It'll only be once, you know. So in thinking about the Goliaths in your life, my Goliath is, I can't turn this last page right now. So again, I don't think there's specific remedies for each and every one of our problems, but I think there are a couple of key points that we can take away from it and put into practice. And point number one, like David, we need to choose our battles. Okay, now sometimes the battles, we don't have a choice. It's our battle. We just have to do it. David didn't have to do it. I mean, there was a whole army. He had 3 older brothers. He chose that battle. But again, all the battles presented to us are not necessarily ours to fight. And we had done a study not too long ago on what Paul in Philippians 4:13 says, and most of you know this passage when Paul said, I can do all things through Christ who strengthened me. Paul does not mean that we are to do all things and then rely on Christ for his strength. Paul meant that for all the things Christ called us to do, Paul could rely, we can rely on Christ to supply the strength that we need to do them. So we're not called to do all things and then ask Christ for strength. We're just called to do the things that he wants us to do and he will provide for us. And then second, point number two is wait on the Lord and choose the right time, his time, to begin the battle. Remember this 40 number. You know, 40 days, it wasn't like on the next morning David got up and went out and started fighting. He might have. I mean, something else might be, you're supposed to do it right now. You're supposed to go do it. Other times, it doesn't mean you're supposed to go do it right now. So I found in my own life, and as I'm getting older, if I wait, and I'm not a waiter, you know, patience is, you can ask the boy out there, you know, patience is not one of my long suits. But I find many times if I wait, there doesn't even need to be a battle. Somehow it resolves itself on its own. I'm not saying to shy away from it. I am saying patience is a virtue. So don't shy away. Patience is a virtue. Maybe you need to jump right in, or maybe you need to wait. All these different answers. I'm just saying that you have to ask God for discernment for the right time to begin. When is the right time? Maybe you're thinking of going back to school or pursuing a new job or something. Maybe today's not the right time to do it. Maybe it's 3 months from now. Maybe it was 3 months ago, so you better start today. I don't know. But certainly waiting is difficult, but maybe God is preparing you in some way. Remember that 40 days is a time of trial and probation, maybe teaching. Boy, he's sorry he came, because I'm going to keep picking on him. Are you running the marathon in October? Okay, so my son and his girlfriend are going to run the Chicago Marathon. I think it's October 4th, but I'm not sure. But anyways, you wouldn't think of, like, on October 1st saying, gee, I'm going to go run the marathon tomorrow, you know. No, you would start preparing, you would start training, you would start, you know, getting ready to do this. So many times that might be what God's doing during the waiting time. I used to swim a lot, long distances and things, and this was 2005, I think. We went out to San Francisco and I swam Alcatraz, which, you know, but I didn't just jump in the water and start doing it. You know, we were swimming several mornings a week in Lake Michigan, you know, since like April, believe it or not. It was pretty cold, but you just don't start these things the day before you're going to do them and expect to be successful at them. So if there's something that you're being called to do, maybe there's some training that you need to get ready to do it. Maybe God just needs to work on you a little bit. Maybe he needs to work up here, more likely in here, in your heart. Whatever the case, Paul had mentioned, I think, last week that most of the elders, I think, and myself and Paul, we were at this Converge banquet, and this pastor, his name was Jeffrey Johnson from this, it's called The Church in Three Locations is the name of this church in Indianapolis. They have 17,000 congregants, and this guy was a great speaker. I really enjoyed him. But he says, whatever the case, whatever's going on in your life, this waiting, this trial, this tribulation, take heart, because the teacher, Jesus, is always with you during the training. Might not seem like it, but trust that he is there. And then I heard this quote once, and I don't know who it's from, but, and you can substitute the word battle for storm, in the quote it uses storm. Don't tell God how big your storm is, or don't tell God how big your battle is. Tell your battle or tell your storm how big your God is, okay? Remember, this is the God that created the heavens and the earth. This is the God that created the human eye. I mean, think about this human eye, what it does, the human body, all these things. This morning, I was telling, where's Joe? I was telling Joe this morning. We have this room in our house. It's a glass room. I mean, you shouldn't live in glass houses, but it's over the lake, and it's glass all the way around, and it's got a glass ceiling. But we don't have any furniture out there. So it's a great place, like when I do my stretches in the morning for my back and stuff. So I'm laying on the floor, and I'm wearing shorts, Joe. I'm wearing my shorts, and I'm doing my stretches, and I'm looking up at the ceiling, at the glass ceiling, and there's this squirrel just up, and this squirrel is looking down at me, and he's like, and I'm looking up at him, and he's looking down at me, and maybe you've heard Paul mention, like, I'm kind of into the squirrels. We have a lot of them. They have no fear. They go up trees, upside down, hang around, jump down. And it's like God created those too. So this is the God that created everything, the heavens, the earth, the stars, the sun, everything that we have. I think we can trust in him and just believe in him, just like Melissa was saying with the tithing. And then point three, depend on the Lord. Always remember that the battle ultimately belongs to Him. The battle is His. Depend on Him by four things that I would suggest. Spending time every day talking, and more important, listening to Him. Somewhere, I'm a morning person, I get up, you don't even know when I get up, it's really early. I like to do it in the morning. I have great conversations with Him. You don't have to be fancy, you don't have to pontificate and use all these, just, hey, God, you know, I'm a little concerned about this, and just talk and then listen to what He has to say. The next thing is spending time every day in His Word, in the Bible, reading something from there, because it's a living Bible. It changes. It doesn't change, really. We're the ones that change. It stays the same, but as we read it, as our experience molds us, and as the Holy Spirit works through us, we get different meaning from it. Sometimes you've read things over and over and over, and then all of a sudden you read it, and it's like, whoa, I never read that before, you know, same book. It's the same thing. So spend time reading, and spend time every day reading His Word. Give thanks for every blessing that you enjoy. And, oh boy, I'm saying way too much, but Paul and Susan are not here. But I give thanks every day. We have three flush toilets in our house that work, okay? Think about that. I mean, we were where there was no flush toilets. There were no toilets. We have hot and cold running water. We have electricity. We have gas. We have appliances, you know. It's like, oh, gee, it's a little cold, so I touch the button on the thermostat, and it goes right up. We have so many things to be grateful for, just physical things. It's just amazing, and I think we take it for granted. We've been working on this for quite a while. My translator from Madagascar, Marina, she's 23 or 24. We're trying to get her here. We've been trying for like almost a year. But getting a visa for her has been very difficult. But one of my concerns of bringing her here is she won't believe it. She won't believe it, what we have here. And it's just hard to imagine. So you got to give thanks for everything. And then the final thing is believe that He will guide you. Believe He will direct you. If you ask, believe and He will do it for you. You just have to have faith. You have to believe. It probably is not going to come the way you think it should come or the way you want it to be. But have faith in Him, because remember, He has plans for you to prosper you. Let's pray. Lord, we thank You for this day. We thank You for the many opportunities we have. We thank You that we can call on You anytime, anywhere in the world, any time of day, that You are a 24/7, 365 God, that You're concerned about each one of us, You're interested in each one of us, even though there's billions of us on this planet, that You hear each one of us. We thank You that You sent Your Word, Your book, Your Bible, that we have that. And we ask that You would increase our faith in You, Lord. That You would increase our faith in You, to trust You more and more, and to continue to give our lives over to You each and every day. We ask this in the name of Your Son, Jesus. Amen.